Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter Janice Ian. Ian became an overnight sensation in the mid-60s at 15 when she wrote and recorded the controversial song Society's Child about interracial romance. She went on to pen such classics as Jesse and At 17, for which she won a Grammy Award in 1975. She's recently released a new CD called Folk is the New Black and is gearing up to embark on a tour which will bring her to the Center for the Arts in Homer on March 9th. I'm speaking with Ian from her studio in Nashville. Welcome to Out of Bounds, Janice Ian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Tish, it's my pleasure. I think this is the furthest ahead we've ever set up an interview.
Listen, you're the child of a music teacher, and you began studying piano at a really, really young age. Do you think you were naturally drawn to music and would have found it anyway if you hadn't been ushered into it by this musical parent?
I don't know if I would have found it anyway if there'd been no instruments or radio in the house. You know, that's kind of hard to tell whether it would have gone in another direction. But from the moment that I realized humans could make music and the sounds coming from the piano were coming from my dad, that was really all I ever wanted to do.
That you're so lucky to have known that at such a young age.
I think so. I think it's the luck of the draw. You know, it's a luck to be born with the talent in the first place, and the luck to be born with the drive and the health, and be born into a time that supports that talent in whatever guise it takes. It's all a lot of luck.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to ask you also, you know, while most adolescents are self-consciously navigating their way through high school, at 15, you penned a really controversial song about interracial romance, and you became an overnight sensation. What was that like for someone so young?
You know, I don't know. I mean, that's the only life that I knew then. So it was fine. It was the same as being an adolescent and not doing it, I guess, except that I was doing it publicly.
Uh-huh. Did you have any idea that that was going to be the beginning of a long career?
I never thought about it. I still don't think about it. You know, I mean, I know other artists think about, will I be remembered after I'm dead? And, you know, I could care less.
Really? I'm actually surprised to hear that, because you've kept on for 40 years.
Well, the alternative is a day job, really. I mean, what else am I going to do with my time?
Uh-huh.
You know, there's no great philosophy behind it or anything, Tish. It's just, I love doing music. I love making music. I love performing and writing and recording. And I think I'm very fortunate that I can earn a living doing those things. And I'm really not trained for anything else. I mean, it's not like I went to college and gave up a good job as a nuclear physicist to become a musician.
Uh-huh. But, you know, you've managed to do it, but was it difficult in the early days to maintain your own unique voice and style? Were you pressured to write formula songs and conform to an image?
Not really. No, it was the 60s, and it was a very different time. Record companies were looking for people who weren't like everybody else, but stood out. So I guess between my size and my hair and my voice, I didn't resemble any other artist, and no one ever tried to change that because I was so obviously not in the kind of Fabian Frankie Avalon mold of of manufactured artists, you know?
Uh-huh.
It was real clear from the start that I was going to write my own songs, that I was going to arrange them, that I was going to sing on them. And I was lucky in the producers I worked with, and people like Shadow or Brooks Arthur thought that was a good thing.
So, well, I always hear these nightmares about how women in music are being told to look sexier and try to play that kind of game, but apparently not in your case, huh?
Well, I don't think there was any hope of that. I mean, I've never been the kind of sexy all-American looking girl, you know, and there's Stella Adler used to say, you can't play two things. You can't play young and you can't play sexy. You either are or you're not.
Uh-huh. You know, you've often been described as an antisocial rebel, especially in the early years. But you know, I think your greatest songs are so intimate. Do you ever feel that you're allowing yourself to be a little bit too vulnerable?
Boy, the vulnerability thing is hard because about the only thing that I do better than my contemporaries in my little niche is to write about things that maybe other people are uncomfortable talking about. And in order to write that kind of song and have it be effective, you've got to let yourself open up and show yourself. So it does require a vulnerability. It was harder when I was younger. It was real hard singing 17 and Stars the first few years just because they were so close to the bone.
Mm-hmm.
But I think now I just accept it as part of what I do.
Mm-hmm. Was the song At 17 something that was coming out of you for years and years, or did it just flow?
It was a long song to write. It took about 3 months at 17. Mm. So I wouldn't say that it just flowed, but it came together nicely. Some songs, when you're finished, you know that it's a good song, but you feel like there were places where you didn't quite hit the mark, mm-hmm. and it doesn't feel natural.
Mm-hmm.
But At 17 has a very logical flow to it, and it feels good to sing it.
You know, a lot of your writing has always reminded me of poetry, of course. Are you a big poetry fan, and have you been affected by many poets?
I find most poetry really hard to read. Hmm. I think probably because words tend to lie flat on a page without music for me. I like it better when it's spoken. I love listening to Dylan Thomas reading his own poetry. But I'm not a huge poetry fan. You know, I think of it as a really distinctly separate art form than songwriting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whole different rhythm.
Yeah, I would assume so, but so many of your songs seem like poetry to me, so
no,
I was just
they don't
wondering.
To me. They just don't hold up at all without music.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Listen, I don't know if you ever officially actually came out, but, you know, for a good number of years, all of us who know about your career have known about the fact that you're a lesbian, and you recently married your partner of 20 years back in 2003, I believe. Do you feel that your sexual minority or outsider status has helped you as a writer?
Wow, that's a great way to phrase it. Has your outsider or minority status helped you as a writer? Huh. You know, I think all writers, rephrase that, all artists, by their nature and by the nature of being an artist, are outsiders and outlaws.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's possible that if I'd grown up in a white, middle-class, Anglo-Christian family, I wouldn't be the same kind of writer. But I certainly know people who've grown up in that circumstance who are great writers. So it's really hard to tell, Tish. You know,
mm-hmm.
the gay thing, God, I was outed in 76 in the Village Voice.
Uh-huh, I remember that, actually.
Yeah, and I guess I came out in 93 when Breaking Silence came out. But
mm-hmm.
to me, it's always been just a fact of life. You know, it's like my partner says, when people start coming out as heterosexuals, I'll feel a need to make a statement as a homosexual. We did get married, though, and that was great.
Uh-huh. But, you know, I would think that one would be more comfortable once one is able to come out, and therefore I was wondering if that had affected even your focus in regard to your career.
No, I mean, I think you're more comfortable once you come out just because you can't be in two places at once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the people I know who are still very closeted, eventually it makes them pretty crazy because they're trying to occupy the same space with two separate bodies. You know, the hiding and stuff, but I've never lived that life.
Mm-hmm.
I've always lived openly with my partners. I've always introduced them to my family, had them be part of my family. I mean, Pat and I are 17, 18 years now. You know, my nephews know her as well as they know me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually great to hear, because I still think the LGBT community needs role models. So
yeah, I think we all need role
mm-hmm.
models. I mean, it's hard when you're a gay kid. You know, we all know that. It's harder if there's no place to go.
Mm-hmm. I want to play an excerpt from one of your most gorgeous and touching recent songs, the one you wrote about Matthew Shepard. He was, of course, the young gay man who was beaten, tied to a fence, and left to die in Wyoming.
Mm.
The song is called Matthew, and it's from your CD, Billy's Bones.
Steps on gravel at the neighborhood bar. things start to unravel, then they go too far. The sound of pain written on the wind fades to gray and then goes dim. Boy is tied to a barbed wire fence for the crows to ride, for the claws to clinch, for the sweet bouquet of blood and bone to undermine the scent of collegiate cologne. What makes a man a man? The cut of a coat, the hint of a tan. It's not who you love, but whether you can. What makes a man a man?
God, Janice, I think this is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard, and it's so reminiscent of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. Was
Thanks.
It meant to be?
Thanks. Quite intentional.
Was that difficult for you to write?
Matthew was rough to write, yeah, because it's always hard to write about something tragic. Mm-hmm. You know, the Holocaust, Matthew Shepard, incest, any of those kind of loaded topics are really difficult because you don't want to downplay it, and yet you don't want to lose the audience halfway through the song.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get enough of your own passion in there, but in my case, I didn't want to end up sounding too angry because people stopped listening then. You know, mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a hard song to write. It was a hard song to sing.
And I think it's so effective because you sing it in such a sweet voice.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, that's the Billie Holiday trick, you know?
Uh-huh. I know Billie Holiday is a big hero of yours. How has she affected your writing and your singing?
Oh, how is she not? I mean, it's still before every album, I go back and listen to her for a couple of weeks just to make sure that my phrasing is clean and my diction is still good and I'm not cheating too much by scooping all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
She's the perfect singer to me, she and George Jones, in mm-hmm. two completely different ways. Billie always sings effortlessly, but it's coming straight from the heart. She's astonishing.
Yeah, I feel the same way. She's actually one of my favorites as well, and I listen to her stuff often, and I'm still amazed at the emotion and the phrasing.
Mm-hmm. Your phrasing is killer.
No one
can
do it.
She always said she phrased like Louis Armstrong.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's such a tragedy that she died so young.
Yeah.
I heard that from the early 80s through the early 90s, you withdrew from public life because you thought your writing was actually going downhill. What did you actually do to recharge?
I moved into a bunch of different fields. I studied acting with Stella Adler and ballet with Dora Kranig and directing with Jose Quintero and Chinese theater with Chow Chow Lin, and just did things that were in the arts but had nothing to do with my work in a direct way, and came away from it a much, much better writer and with a much better understanding of myself as an artist in the world.
How did studying directing refocus you in that way?
Well, directing really teaches you to look at the stage as a whole and to look at the time on stage as a whole, as opposed to individual songs or individual moments. Teaches you about lights, teaches you about entrances, teaches you about audiences. A good director, somebody like Quintero, you know, they shred the piece apart and then put it back together.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a handy thing to know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that I know how to do it, but, you know, at least I got a glimmering.
Yeah. I actually saw one of his productions of a Eugene O'Neill play in Los Angeles a good number of years ago, and it was just astonishing. It was with Colleen Dewhurst.
Oh.
Yeah, The Moon for the Misbegotten.
Moon for the Misbegotten, yeah.
Yeah. So I know what you mean about his direction.
Yeah, Quintero's amazing.
Mm-hmm. You're such an accomplished musician and singer, but I've always sensed that your writing means more to you than anything. Am I right about
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. To me, the writing always comes first, and protecting the writing always comes first, because without the writing, there's nothing else.
Uh-huh. And do you write lyrics before you write the music, or how do you do that?
No, I'm one of those lucky people where it kind of all comes together at once. I've done it both ways. You know, I've written lyrics to pre-existing music and set lyrics to my own music, but neither one is as satisfying to me as sitting down and just writing a song.
Hmm. Are you somebody who writes everywhere? Like if you're in a restaurant, you're
yeah.
writing on matchbooks? And
yeah, my partner says when I get that glazed look and my lips start moving, everybody should just leave me alone.
So do you wake up in the middle of the night and start writing as well?
No, I'm too old to be waking up in the middle of the night.
Now, I don't believe that.
No, you should, yeah.
Really?
Reaching my dotage.
Huh. Because I actually wake up in the middle of the night with questions that I want to ask my upcoming guests.
Oh, no. I guess I don't worry about it too much, you know, and it doesn't weigh on my mind. I'm more likely to wake up in the middle of the night worried about a tour.
Ah. You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. I'm Tish Perlman, and I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Janice Ian from her studio in Nashville.
That would be in Tennessee.
That's right. Listen, I want to play a cut from your new CD, Folk
Great.
Is the New Black. This, you know, this CD seems to touch on a lot of Janice Ian moods. You know, it's partially political, and it's witty, and it's playful. And actually, the cut I want to play now is called The Great Divide.
No, I like that song.
Tell us about it.
Well, I don't normally write political songs because they tend not to be listened to very well in the modern age. You know, people are sort of, I don't know, this is a horrible thing to say, but people are sort of over that. And it's not like the 60s where we really felt that with every political step forward we were making strides. Now it's just this kind of huge abyss that sucks you down. And you're sitting there in the quicksand, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But at the time that I wrote The Great Divide this last March, April, a lot of bad stuff was going on politically. And I really got fed up. You know, it's unfortunate that I was home every day and reading the newspapers each morning. And the song grew out of that. You know, it grew out of just a feeling that those of us who are still in our minds and hearts activists and who still believe that the world can change and that people are essentially good, don't have any kind of rallying point. You know, we've forgotten that there's a place for the good people to gather together and organize and make some changes.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's really what the song is about. It just says, you know, don't sit there with your head in the sand anymore. Get up.
Yeah, I actually think there is a place in this culture politically and culturally for more political songs. Because I am one of those people that's awfully fed up, too.
Mm.
And I was actually glad to hear this song coming
Good.
Out of you.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. I like your line about politicians lie and cheat.
To get to higher ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. All that was before New Orleans.
Was it really?
Yeah, yeah. Songs are weird that way. Songs are prescient.
Uh-huh. Do you think you'll write a song about New Orleans?
I think I've already written it. I mean, it's The Great Divide. You know, I just happened to write it 8 months before it happened.
So this is the one that you would attribute to that. Yeah, and things are still bad there. I've heard. I have friends there.
Yeah, me too.
Have you visited?
No, I felt no need to go visit. I'm more curious about what Arkansas is going to do with all those tractor trailers and trailer homes that are sinking. I love that story.
You know, I also want to bring up the fact that the note that's on your new CD that you sang all the vocals live.
That's our kind of finger to the industry.
Really? Explain.
Well, when you're in the recording studio, the traditional way to do it is you record the band, and then after the band have gone home, you come in as a singer and you sing in this real protected environment where everything is done to ensure that you're comfortable, and the only thing you have to concentrate on is singing. And you can sing the song 50, 60, as many times as you want, and then they can do, the engineers can do everything from fixing it so that you're in tune if you're out of tune, to chopping together little bits of it, like a word from this take and a word from that take, to assemble the whole vocal. And that's how pretty much everybody's doing it these days. I just felt like I really wanted to make a folk album, and part of folk's authenticity is that it's real and it's in the moment. So in order to do that, I really had to be singing as we were recording the band, as I was playing my own instrument. And it worked out really well. I was in good voice that week, and the weather was good and just slightly damp, which is perfect for a singer. And I was comfortable with the songs and with the musicians. So when we finished and we were putting together the artwork, someone suggested that we put that line in, because it is getting rarer and rarer for somebody to be able to pull that off.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds gorgeous, too.
Thank you.
It does.
Good engineer, Chad Haley.
When you do it over and over and over again, I assume it loses something. So this makes it really immediate.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, sometimes you do it over and over again and it gains something. I mean, the vocal to Matthew, I sang every day for 5 days till I nailed it. It just depends on the mood of the record and the mood of the songs. These songs were written to lend themselves to being folk songs, to being able to be performed with just a guitar or sung along to. So that leads you right into recording the vocals live.
Why do you think you're heading back into the folk traditions specifically?
Well, I took the pop thing and the electronic thing as far as I wanted to take it with God and the FBI. And Billy's Bones was kind of a hybrid. And when it came time to do this album, I had hit my 50s, and I was really busy trying to simplify things rather than complicate them. You know, when you're young, complicating things and drama, that's all great.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get older, you go, wow, why am I wasting so much time? So just a drive towards simplicity.
I think that's fascinating. I think simplicity is probably the best way to communicate anyway. So, I also want to talk to you about, because like we were talking before about how much your writing means to you, I noticed that you often collaborate with people. How does that work?
Depends on the other writer. Sometimes it'll be somebody I know well, and they'll call me and say, hey, I have an idea, and we'll get together. Or sometimes you'll literally book an appointment, sit down at 9 or 10 a.m., and bat around things until you come up with something you both like and go from there. It's a good way to keep from getting into a rut, you know, because I've been doing this, man, I've been a songwriter since I was 12.
Yes.
So that's 42 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy, just like with any other job, it's easy to start taking things for granted and to start relying on what you know will work. And writing with someone else takes you right out of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still enjoy touring like you did when you were younger? Is it a new experience in any way?
I think I enjoy it a lot more than I did when I was younger. You know, again, the difference between being young enough to sustain a lot of drama and a lot of nonsense and wasted time. As I get older, I try and save that drama and that passion for my work and not waste it on being silly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in that sense, I enjoy the touring more because it's a lot calmer. And I like my audiences. You know, I correspond with them on my message board, and I answer their emails. And I think they feel a sense of honesty from me that they're not getting most places they go.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always nice. And
yeah.
I love to sing. I mean,
yeah.
I love to play. I love to sing. So it's a good job.
Yeah, it is. And you're doing a good job of it.
Thank you.
I actually have looked on your message board, and I've noticed how many people have said that Janis is speaking to me again, like she did.
Yeah, it's interesting, the reaction to this new record. It's real different from the last couple. Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that. Speaking to me like she hasn't since Between the Lines.
Well, that's what we felt. I mean, when Philip, my co-manager, and I started talking about this, it felt like this record was going to come full circle, and I was kind of going to wind up back where I started with Between the Lines. Mm-hmm. It's certainly as eclectic an album as that, and yet it seems to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about something you created called the Pearl Foundation, which is in honor of your mother. Tell us about this.
Well, my mom had MS, and she died of it eventually, but there were about 20, 25 years there where it was a slow decline, and she couldn't work anymore at one point. My brother and I were worried about her because she fell into a deep depression, and she had always wanted to go to college, but, you know, her generation of women didn't usually go to college. She had put my dad and my brother through college. So we suggested that she go back to school, and I funded it. And she went to Goddard, and she got her BA and her MA, and it kept her alive for many, many years that I think she would not have enjoyed but for Goddard. So when she died, we held an internet auction, pre-eBay, and auctioned off everything from first drafts of songs to old master tapes, in order to establish a scholarship in her name, and we wound up establishing six. We raised $73,000. And then people kept giving me money for the foundation, except there wasn't a foundation. So about, 8 years ago, we finally incorporated and became a bona fide IRS-approved organization. And now we raise money lots of different ways. I do living room concerts, which are private concerts, and 100% of that goes to the foundation. We have a tip jar at the shows. We ask people to just give us their change. That raised about $8,000 last year. We do special items through the website for the foundation. And we have a bunch of buttons you can hit because we offer things like free downloads of my music. And we say, look, you know, if you want to contribute to something and earn some good karma, give us a buck through this. And they can make a contribution through PayPal or Amazon Honors. So, you know, it's very grassroots, but we're on our 14th scholarship now, which is a pretty cool thing.
Hmm. That's terrific.
Yeah.
We're almost running out of time, but I wanted to ask you this really briefly. Is it true that you're planning to take 2007 off to write your autobiography?
Yes. Frightening as the thought may be.
You expect to spend the whole year doing that?
Well, I've never written a book before, you know, and we're all feeling like better to have too much time than too little. So I'm figuring it's not going to take the whole year, but certainly finishing it and then doing the editorial process with the editor and then putting that back together, yeah, I think it'll take the better part of the year.
Mm. Oh, that's something really to look forward to.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah. How can people get in touch with you? What's your website address?
JanisIan.com. Well, www.JanisIan.com. Or you can go to Google and just feed in my name, and there I am.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Janis. We will look forward to seeing you at the Center for the Arts in Homer on March 9th. And in the meantime, good luck with your tour.
Thanks. I did mean to mention that I do stay after the show and meet people and sign stuff. So if anybody wants to bring old vinyl or CDs, they're more than welcome to, Tish.
Great.
Cool. I look forward to seeing Homer again.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's been an honor having you on the show, Janis.
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.